Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
This is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
That third voice was our colleague Sebastian Klovig-Skelton. Hey, Seb. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Been about a year since you were on last May.
Oh, has it been that long already? Wow.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
And you'd interviewed Shoshana Zuboff.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right about the surveillance capitalism stuff. Yeah, no, that's amazing how long ago that was at this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, today we're missing our beloved colleague, Claire McDonald, who'll be back in due course. Seb's here in his own right, but he also is, in a sense, standing in for Claire, who will no doubt listen to the podcast. So
there will be a test, Claire, just so you know.
Well, this time we've cleared the decks for Seb. We're going to talk about Uber's legal issues versus some of its drivers, what that means for the gig economy, and so on. But the last time you were on, Seb, we were asking our guests to see how they were getting on in lockdown, various hobbies and pastimes and Netflix specials and stuff. We're not going to do that now. That was the first lockdown a whole year ago. But we are going to ask, what are you looking forward to most post-lockdown?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm glad I'm not having to answer a question about hobbies because they've dried up at this point and there's nothing to do. but I think, you know, in terms of what I'm looking forward to when things open up a bit more, it's just a bit more spontaneity, I guess. Go to pubs and stuff now, but good luck trying to get to one without booking like at least one or two weeks in advance. So yeah, I'm just looking forward to that aspect of it, being able to text people like, what are you doing tonight, and then going out and doing something that night instead of having to plan like 2 weeks ahead.
Yeah,
I think that's what I'm looking forward to.
Operation. Yeah,
yeah. And like me and my friends, we can't organize anything, so we need that spontaneity back.
And yourself, Caroline, what are you craving?
Yeah, Seb's pretty much hit a nail on the head for me as well. It's just like, you know, that whole kind of, hey, let's just pop into the pub for a pint. It's like, oh no, have you got your track and trace information? Have you got your phone? Have you got a mask? Have you got this? Da-da-da. Oh, okay. Let's just go home to our separate homes because we're not allowed to mix indoors. I don't know. I know there's a few people who kind of feel this way, but I am feeling that I'm really excited about everything opening up, but we've been locked down for so long now. I'm also feeling a little bit anxious about everything opening up again and like sort of, you know, what's it going to be like? You know, in theory, I can't wait to go back to the pub again, but will I feel okay being in the pub? Just thinking like, am I going to be looking at all the other pub goers like as potential germ sponges? And like, what disease are you going to give me? Even like, that kind of thing.
Hazards. People have become biohazards. It's like our mentality. Yeah, definitely. Well, I suppose one thing we can't really do now is travel. So quite looking forward to various aspects of travel, specifically, I suppose, seeing my family. So I haven't seen a blood relative since March 2020. You can see little violins coming out. Yeah.
No, I'm the same. I've got lots of nieces and nephews that, you know, in pre-COVID, we'd be in each other's lives a lot more, doing stuff together and things like that. And suddenly it's just like, oh, we can do a Zoom call. I don't know if you've ever tried to get a young child on a Zoom call. Like, if you know, we get Zoom fatigue doing meetings, but when they've been homeschooling as well, and it's just like, oh, do you want to hop on a Zoom call? Like, nah, kind of seems like schoolwork. Like, oh, okay, bye. You know, you just can't talk to each other otherwise.
Definitely. I'm quite looking forward to getting a cold, like an old-fashioned...
Oh, I wouldn't. No.
I don't know. I was enjoying the Christmas period this year because usually, like, start of January, late December, I end up with the worst flu like every year, and it just didn't happen this year. So I quite enjoyed that, to be honest.
See, again, maybe this is just speaking to my kind of just anxiety, health anxiety, whatever, about all of this whole pandemic situation. But I've started getting hay fever at the moment because obviously it's seasonal, and yeah, it's playing that. It's playing that thing of, oh my god, is this hay fever or could this be COVID?
Or is it?
Yeah. So, yeah, even just like a slight cold, I think, would send me up the wall at the minute.
Oh, well, I can see I'm alone on that one. The idea of a five-day cold, it comes, it goes, you don't die of it, and you can spend at least a day under the duvet watching stuff on your iPad or some other device. But, yeah, travel would be the big thing, I think, probably for me, although I'm not looking forward to going back to America, has to be said. Anyway, look, before we get down to the main business of the episode, I wanted to draw attention to a very important development today, So we're recording on Friday, the 23rd of April. So today, 39 sub-postmasters had their convictions quashed at the Court of Appeal. These sub-postmasters and sub-postmistresses, for people who haven't heard about this, were accused of financial crimes that were the fault of a computer system known as Horizon. And it is a terrible story of injustice. And the individual stories are just heartbreaking. You hear some of the people being interviewed on the TV and radio today. Anyway, they've had their names cleared. It's a massive story, and one that Computer Weekly, specifically and mainly our colleague Carl Flinders, has been covering since 2009. And one convenient way into the story is to listen to our podcast about it. Caroline, Claire and I talked about this with Carl himself. That podcast was published on the 23rd of February, if you want to go looking for it, entitled Post Office Horizon and the Sub-Postmaster's Justice Fight. Very important story and a fantastic outcome. Today, we're discussing another struggle of working people against very powerful organisations with a great deal of clout. Caroline, can I invite you please to get the ball rolling on this with Seb? We've got questions for him.
Yes, all about the gig economy. So the gig economy promises many good things for consumers, including the ability to summon a cab at the swipe of an app or get takeaways and groceries delivered to our doors in a matter of minutes. But what is becoming increasingly clear is there is a human cost to all this convenience now. As details start to emerge about the relatively low pay and lack of benefits the people responsible for literally keeping the wheels of the gig economy turning receive. So there's been the Uber case, which Seb is going to talk us through shortly, as well as the news that came out ahead of Deliveroo's IPO that some of its potential investors actually backed out of buying shares in the firm because of concerns over the rights afforded to its delivery drivers. So just hours before the recording today, we had the news that the Court of Appeal had dismissed Addison Lee's bid to overturn the conclusion of a 2017 employment tribunal that ruled its drivers should be considered workers and are therefore entitled to receive minimum wage and holiday pay and other benefits too. It's an issue that the Association of Independent Professionals and the Self-Employed Trade Body has been quite vocal on in terms of the need for the government to step in and try and clear up the confusion about how gig economy workers should be paid and rewarded for the work they do. So in response to the Addison Lee ruling today, their CEO, Derek Cribb, released quite an interesting statement, which I think just kind of really helps to get to the crux of the issue here and just really shine a light on just the complexity surrounding all this. His quote is, "The gig economy is a tangled mix, not only of people who should truly be categorised as workers, but also a large number of legitimately self-employed people who rely on the flexibility that freelancing offers, both to restore the rights of exploited workers and also to secure freedom and flexibility for the legitimately self-employed people. We urge the government to write into law a clear definition of self-employment. This is the true source of confusion in the gig economy." So I think that's quite interesting. And as you said, it's certainly a tangled mix of issues coming to the fore here with this whole debacle. But it does seem like the tide is turning somewhat on how the drivers, the riders and the couriers that make up the gig economy are paid and the benefits they receive. So, Seb, starting with the Supreme Court decision made in February this year in the Uber case, can you talk us through some of the issues, you know, specifically on that part of it? Because that is seen as quite a landmark kind of ruling in all of this.
Yeah. So in terms of, I guess, the the key things, the employment status, isn't it, and what these workers are classified as. So obviously Uber and others, you know, Ola, Bolt, have maintained for years that their drivers are kind of their self-employed independent workers on the basis that the apps basically connect drivers with potential customers. And, you know, this is a position that Uber's maintained through kind of years of court proceedings. That the original employment tribunal that started off the Supreme Court case happened in 2016. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been going on for a long time, but that 2016 employment tribunal is what that their decision is what the Supreme Court upheld. So we've had since 2016 decisions being made in courts that drivers should be treated as workers rather than self-employed individuals. And you know, you're probably quite familiar with this with your IR35 stuff, Caroline. But obviously, there's like different types of employment in the UK. Which there isn't necessarily elsewhere. So there's the self-employed, and then there's the quote unquote workers, and then there's just employees. And basically by being, you know, by being classed as workers rather than self-employed individuals, you know, that comes with a whole range of additional benefits, you know, including the right to be paid national minimum wage, to receive the statutory minimum holiday pay and rest breaks, and importantly in the specific Supreme Court case with Uber, protection from unlawful discrimination and whistleblowing. So yeah, it's kind of, it's interesting because it's set a pretty big precedent, right? So it's the Supreme Court. It's like, you can't go any further. There's no more appeals that Uber could have, even if they wanted to thing. And there's what, there's 5 million plus gig workers in the UK.
It's a big population, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, definitely. It's a massive part of the workforce, and it's an important decision. I guess we're already kind of seeing some issues in terms of how it's being implemented. So obviously that Supreme Court case was on the 19th of February. And then on the 17th of March, Uber announced that drivers will get holiday pay to just over 12% of earnings, entitled to automatic enrollment in workplace pension schemes, and will earn the national living wage, which I think is $8.72 an hour. And that happened on 17th of March. So a bit of a delay, but even within that, Uber's come out and it's not really respected the ruling properly. So the Supreme Court in its decision explicitly ruled that workers are, or drivers are workers, as in the formal, you know, legal classification, from the minute they log on to the app to the minute they log off, which basically means they should get paid from when they become active, not simply when passengers are on board and they're on trips. But Uber decided that the higher wages it's now giving drivers would only apply, quote unquote, from the time you accept a trip on the app to the point at which the trip completes. So there's already kind of ways they're getting around it a little bit. I know on that day, the 17th of March, the Uber CEO actually, he wrote like an op-ed in the Evening Standard, which, you know, my personal view is it was quite egregious, because it basically posited this whole thing as like a decision that Uber decided to take almost out of the goodness of their hearts, was how it was framed, when it's, well, you didn't just decide to do this, you know, you fought it every step of the way. The Supreme Court decided something, and even then you're not really respecting it necessarily. So yeah, I mean, the implications are huge. Like, obviously the Addison Lee thing, I'm sure might not have been ruled the same way had it not already been for this decision. Obviously been having internet troubles this morning, so I haven't had to be looking into the details of that too closely yet. But you know, in terms of like further actions, I guess, I've been in touch with Keller Linkner, which is a law firm. They were already representing, I think it was 9,000 drivers for compensation claims against Uber related to the Supreme Court ruling, you know, with the potential, I think, to claim back between £10,000 and £12,000 for each driver. And so it's, so 9,000 drivers are involved with Keller Linkner in doing that. Another 3,000 with Lee Day, and Keller Linkner kind of confirmed to me that because of the way that Uber has implemented the Supreme Court decision, that may lead to further litigation. But obviously, you know, it's a slow process getting all that stuff going. So I haven't heard much about it since I last spoke to them, I think a couple of weeks ago. It's definitely going to be challenged somewhere. They're already being challenged for that compensation as a result of the Supreme Court decision. And then because of how Uber implemented that decision, there's probably going to be further litigation again, because it's like, you didn't really implement it how they said. I think from what I've seen, Uber's argument is that because drivers are quote unquote multi-apping, that's how the gig economy is running now. It's basically it's different market conditions to 2016 when the Employment Tribunal decision was made. So they're arguing, well, if we pay someone, they'll just keep Uber active in the background while they do these trips for other companies, is their kind of logic. There doesn't seem to be anything out there. It's just that multi-apping is a really widespread practice on that level. There's just not much out there to say either way. But the argument is that, you know, drivers and couriers and riders would turn to multi-apping because they're not being treated very well and they need to like get more money somehow. So
that was going to be something I was going to ask, actually, is that, well, you know, that kind of way of working would only probably crop up because, let's say, people aren't earning enough to just rely on one app for their income and things like that. But I think the thing that really strikes me on this story is like how you have companies trying to set, this is what the working relationship is between us and our drivers. Like, we've designated that it's self-employed, but then the reality of the working relationship is that, no, actually, based on the court version, they are workers for you. You know, that your company would not run or bring in anyone if you didn't have these people to rely on. They're relying on your app to get work and things like that. You control a lot of how their ability to work and find work, and the rating system as well feeds into that a lot as well. I say it's just interesting, you know, sort of companies that, okay, it benefits us to have everyone self-employed, but the reality of the working relationship means they're not self-employed. At the end of the day, it's the benefit of the company to have them as self-employed people rather than for the benefit of the workers, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And what you said there is exactly right. Like the Employment Tribunal decision from 2016 said exactly that. It was that written agreement that was in place between drivers and Ubers didn't really reflect the reality of the situation and the power dynamics between them. For example, like Uber is completely responsible for dictating how much drivers are paid for the work they do, and that there's all kinds of like controls they have over that work through, you know, the algorithms in terms of who gets assigned what, and, you know, some of, I guess, policies against disciplining drivers and things like that. It's all done by Uber through the app and that. And if you don't accept a certain number of rides, they stop sending them to you, things like this. So yeah, I mean, Uber has a significant amount of control over drivers' livelihoods, basically. And I think that the Employment Tribunal decision and the later Supreme Court decision kind of needed to reflect that, which they did.
So the court cases and the news of the Deliveroo IPO as well, it has sort of shone a light on what the working arrangements are between these firms. Do you think consumers are likely to take notice of that and be kind of surprised that, you know, we all just think, oh, okay, we can summon an Uber to our house and I can go from A to B and it's relatively cheap? Do you think people have made that connection before, that actually this is going to come at a cost of somebody probably not being paid very well for this?
In kind of, I guess, 2012 kind of time, this is just anecdotal, but I remember like ordering Ubers back then and they were really cheap, like really cheap. And I think that it's probably getting to the point now where there's so much in the public consciousness about the treatment that the people that, you know, Uber drivers, delivery riders, all people who work for all kinds of companies like that, they don't necessarily have it that great in terms of their working conditions and how much they're paid. The decisions that have been made in courts, it will probably increase overheads for these companies. They're going to have to pay more, provide more privileges and rights to their drivers, which is going to come at a cost, which, you know, a lot of people argue will push up the cost of the service generally. But I don't really, to my mind, that doesn't really seem like that big of a deal. You know, if you're one of the things that Yasin Aslam spoke to me about, who was the main defendant in the Uber case, who was a former Uber driver, was that, you know, initially it was a pretty good deal working for Uber and customers actually quite liked it because of the control it gave them over their journeys. You know, no standing outside a pub or whatever, just on the phone to your cab driver trying to find him,
waving your arm in the air every time.
Like they took all of that out and it was quick, it gave you control and it was cheaper. Consumers should probably just, if they want these services, I think they've got to understand that, you know, they do come at a cost. And if you have to pay a bit more so the person driving you is paid properly, you know, I think that's acceptable, really. Yeah. You know, public transport in London's pretty good. So it's, yeah, you know, get the bus if you don't like it, really.
which is just which good advice anyway.
Suggestion. Yeah.
Obviously, if you've got companies that are able to operate with lower overheads by, like, for instance, not paying their staff what they're due, or, you know, what they should be paying them, it does sort of create a level playing field now, that, you know, that companies that maybe suffered competitively because they're not able to operate the same way that company, like some gig economy companies do as well. So that would potentially generate more choice in the market for consumers, which can be a good thing if everyone is, like I say, playing by the rules. And
but in my mind as well, it's like, well, if you can't compete, your company should probably fold, right? I thought capitalism. I thought that's how it should work. You know, so if, you know, if you all of a sudden you can't compete because, you know, you've been told to treat your workers properly, should you really be a company? I'm not sure you should.
We haven't got a viable business model, have you, really?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I thought the whole idea of the free market was that if you can't compete, you're going to fail. So I don't know. To me, when people make those kind of points, I'm just I don't really buy it too much. But I can see why Uber executives and other people that are in charge of these companies would be a bit worried. And as well, going back to the compensation thing, you know, it's something like What was it? Yeah, 11,000 drivers, 9,000 with Keller Lenkner and 3,000 with Lee Day, litigating against the company. And it's UK, and that's in the UK, and its whole UK workforce is between 60 and 70,000. So if each of those 11,000 is paid out 10 to 12K, that's a massive cost to the company. So I mean, it will be interesting to see where that goes. And you'd think that it would be an incentive for other companies that haven't been forced to make the decision to start implementing these things now, just for like pure financial reasons, to kind of, I guess, to try and avoid paying that kind of compensation out, because it will get legally challenged now. There's that, it's a Supreme Court precedent. That definitely goes quite a long way, I think.
Yes, except tell us about Yassin. He sounds like a big character, and now tell us a bit about his case and how he got started and stuff.
Sure. So yeah, he so Yassine was started working as a private hire driver in London in 2006, and ended up moving to work for Uber around 2013 when it launched its Uber X service. I can't remember exactly what one that is. I think it's just a slightly bigger car or something.
Yeah, I think it's like the Galaxy rather than a little Prius, I think.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, but he started working for them anyway when that came out in around 2013. And he actually said, kind of touched on it briefly, that it was initially quite an attractive prospect working for Uber. We mentioned before that consumers got better control over the rides and having to stand outside, having to hail a cab down at 2 in the morning or whatever. And he was saying, that everything's managed by an app, which is quite nice. It undercut control of the operators and cab offices. And kind of undermined the, I guess, the informal power dynamics and what he called a quote unquote system of favoritism that had developed throughout the industry. So, like, for example, if the guy that's operating your cab office doesn't really like you, he'll give you the crap jobs, basically, and like can control how much you earn. And at that time as well, around 2013, it's like I said, going back, when I was personally getting Ubers in like 2012 and stuff, remembering how cheap it was. And he was saying so the but he was saying the fares were pretty good at the time. That around this time as well, drivers were benefiting from quite a bit of surge time, but it was a bit of a honeymoon period. So, around the end of 2013, start of 2014, anecdotally at least, I mean, he says that, this was kind of the time when drivers were starting to make quite a few complaints to Uber about, being assaulted or being on the receiving end of racist abuse.
A lot of the drivers are like first or second generation immigrants, aren't they, to the UK? Sociologically, that's how it has been.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's, I mean, the quote unquote BAME category has, when you disaggregate that, you could, it's a bit, it can be a bit problematic, but I think 94% of Uber drivers, I think Yassine was telling me, are BAME individuals. A staggering, it's a huge amount. But yeah, but like, so yeah, they were suffering a lot of racist abuse, basically, not really being taken all that seriously necessarily, because I know there's a pattern, and lots of drivers have come out and said this, of like when there's a complaint about them, it's they're dealt with pretty swiftly, but when there's a complaint about a passenger, either assaulting someone or the racist abuse, for example, the company is pretty slow to get anything done about it. So, for example, in the case of James Farrar, who was one of the co-defendants alongside Yassine, he got assaulted, and it took Uber, I think it was 10 weeks, to give police information about the passenger. Uber's, it's got, you got to protect passenger data as well. There's a privacy element there. This is one of their own drivers that's being assaulted. You'd think they'd be much quicker to cooperate or to do something about it. And Yassine told me as well that, drivers, they carry all their own overheads as well. So Uber is basically trying to offload as much many costs and liabilities to drivers as they can. But but so that's kind of the backdrop to how his case started, what was going on at the time. And, you know, because of these sorts of things, Yassine was organizing with other Uber drivers, which led to his first deactivation from the app.
That's a word, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's the official terminology of it. Yeah, you get deactivated. Better than terminated, I suppose. Yeah. Remember when I was speaking to Chris Smalls from the Amazon stuff, they terminated his employment, which sounds unnecessarily aggressive.
Yeah, it doesn't really do a lot for the optics of gig economy workers. Oh, you're just robots to serve, like the
it's a bit horrible. But yeah, I mean, so he was deactivated that time, but he was reinstated after, you know, a formal meeting with the company. From my understanding, you know, I don't know too many details of what went on at that meeting, but you know, they managed to resolve it. He got reinstated, but then, you know, he continued organizing, and eventually this kind of led him to becoming a whistleblower in a Guardian story. It was pretty big from 2015. I've read through the story, and he's not mentioned in it because he's obviously, you know, their source for it, kind of thing, at least in part. There was a story about Uber accepting fake insurance paperwork from drivers. There's like a loophole in their digital, not an identity system, but you know what I mean? To the digital thing you had to put your papers into to do, there was problems with it.
Document verification or something.
Yes, yeah, something like that. But you know, that it led to a formal investigation by the regulator, which in London is obviously Transport for London. And you know, once that, you know, loophole in the system was closed that allowed people to upload the kind of false documents, you know, Yassine was kicked off the platform again, at which point, and I'm not clear exactly who did the reporting, but he was reported to both police and TfL, I think, for his involvement in whistleblowing. He needed to be protected as a whistleblower. So to do this, he needed
to be a worker.
He needed that worker status. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, he himself thought it was clear from Uber's conduct and his, you know, relationship in practice to them was, he saw him as definitely a worker, but, you know, this needed to be proved in court because, again, Uber was maintaining, you know, it's merely a technology provider. All it does is connect drivers to customers, and those drivers are basically acting as independent contractors. So yeah, that's basically how the case started. Obviously James Farrer, who was assaulted, was involved in this case as well. And then they went to that employment tribunal in 2016, which ruled that they were, you know, they should be treated as workers. And then it's obviously taken all this time, you know, February 21 from 2016, for it to get to that stage has taken a long time. Why Yassine was organised in the first place and kind of how this started. He basically needed that whistleblower protection. But I think, you know, and Yassine said this himself, the most important and the biggest thing to come out of it is the better pay for drivers, both in terms of, you know, the actual wage they get and their holiday pay and their entitlement to breaks and things like that. And he, you know, when I was speaking to him, he said it was absolutely key that... how the Supreme Court ruled that from when drivers log on. Because, you know, he was saying to me, if he's sat outside Heathrow waiting for someone to drive home or whatever, he's not sat there for fun. You know, he's at work, should be paid. But yeah, so he said that was a pretty big part of the ruling. And I think, you know, from what I've, you know, when I've spoken to him here and thereafter, him and his union, the App Drivers and Couriers Union, ADCU, are definitely, I think, taking that forward in some form of litigation for not respecting the ruling, basically. But yeah, I think that's all the relevant background to kind of how it developed and how it ended up where it was.
So that's one of the fascinating things to me about this, guys, is the role of unions in fighting for workers' rights in the gig economy. You've seen Islam's union there, Seb. Just tell us a little bit about that, because they're not traditional unions, are they? They have emerged very recently and so on. So it's fascinating.
Yassine's union are fairly new. You know, yeah, they're fairly new, and they're pretty much all made up of, you know, people working in the gig economy. I think they're all mainly Uber drivers because, you know, both Yassine and James Farrer were organising with the IWGB, the International Workers of Great Britain, but due to various disagreements, they ended up splitting. But, you know, IWGB still has its private hire drivers. I think United Private Hire Drivers branch, yeah, UPHD, and they represent a lot of, delivery riders and things like that. But yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing to take away from the union involvement and from, you know, this is all based on my conversation with Yassine, is that, you know, taking on companies like Uber is a super time-consuming process. Not even just time-consuming, I guess, just the amount of energy it would consume from you on a personal level, and especially for people that are, you know, you're trying to work, trying to earn a living. If I had to take tech target to court, for example, I can't imagine how long and tedious that would be while trying to get paid. And so, you know, people get worn out, tired, burnt out. So they're kind of a good way of, you know, you got that support network kind of built around you to get what you need done. And I think a key part here again is that the ADCU specifically is a really workers led union. So, you know, they're all Uber drivers. They all understand very well how the business works, the what kind of things would make their working lives better because they live it every day.
They're immersed completely.
Exactly. And I think that's why a lot of drivers did end up being attracted to the ADCU, because they could see, you know, being fellow Uber drivers or other kinds of drivers or couriers, that, you know, these people kind of understand what's going on and how, the problems you're facing, I guess. People understand how they all work. And, you know, a lot of the legal actions being taken now are being led by unions. So it is just kind of a good way of building collective power among workers generally, I think. But especially in terms of the gig economy, where it's like, you know, most companies don't even treat them as workers. So to have that kind of collective power enables them to take these kind of actions and fund them as well. Like taking Uber to court, I imagine, wasn't cheap. Yeah. And the union definitely played a role with kind of raising funds for that. And, you know, even on the PR side, it's quite helpful to have a structure there that can, you know, get information out quickly and that can act as a contact point for the issues you're organizing around.
Definitely.
So yeah, they're supporting all kinds of cases against Uber, and there's been a few of them now. I know that the biggest thing that ADCU and other unions to an extent as well, in terms of the work they're doing in the gig economy, is really trying to gain access to the data about drivers and understanding how these platforms' algorithms work, and how that relates to, you know, the precarity or not of these people's employment, and what kind of impact that has. So yeah, I know that ADCU specifically, for example, identified 7 cases of Uber drivers having lost their jobs and subsequently getting their licenses revoked by TfL because of some facial verification stuff going wrong. And, you know, would that have got as much attention or be pushed in the way it was without that kind of support structure of that union? I'm not sure. It's good for drivers to kind of organize around, and it acts as a focal point for action, I suppose. But having said that, I mean, there must be quite a lot of drivers and stuff, riders, couriers that aren't unionized still. So I suppose that the argument there could be that, you know, they might not feel the need because they like, Uber's talking point is always, they like the flexibility and things like that. So there's no need for them to unionize, which, you know, is probably true for some people. I think finish up on that union point, the next thing they're really looking at, drivers' rights to data about them and figuring out the algorithmic processes that kind of govern the platform. So for example, that again James Farrar and the ADCU, they've got this idea of the workers info exchange, which is essentially, might be too much to go into now in terms of what the data trust is, But they're trying to kind of build up their own data trust by gaining access to more data about drivers.
Interesting.
Which is, you know, it's essentially what, you know, so they can use the data for kind of collective bargaining purposes and things like that. So that'll be interesting to see where that goes. And, you know, I think they're just at the stage now where they just need the data to get that going, really.
So it's kind of going beyond traditional trade unionism in terms of employee rights, but it's this, it's a digital aspect that goes on their side as well as on the side of the Ubers and Deliveroos of this world. What's happening with the Deliveroo riders?
There was obviously that massive, there was a big strike that happened a couple of weeks ago. On the first day that Deliveroo started trading as a, you know, public company on the London Stock Exchange. But that all basically kicked off from my understanding, because the Bureau of Investigative Journalism did this analysis of 2,600 something invoices from 318 riders. And found that one in three made less than $8.72 an hour, which is the national minimum wage for over 25, which is pretty awful. That's kind of what that's what kicked it all off, really. That led to some major investors pulling out ahead of the IPO. I think it was roughly 10 or 12 or something like that, ended up being like, we're not gonna put money into Deliveroo now because of these concerns over, you know, workers' paying conditions and stuff like that.
Given the sort of investor interest there, or lack of interest because of, you know, concerns over workers' rights, do you think this could open up the market to new challenges to Uber, Deliveroo, people who might put front and centre the fact, oh, you know, we hire our workers directly, they're, say, workers from the get-go, you know, we're a bit more ethical in how we operate and things like that. I know there's, I can't remember the name of the company now, but there's a food delivery place that it has launched, food delivery app that is launching, that is basically putting that front and centre of all their materials.
Oh.
So do you think that, you know, from consumers, you know, that might be attractive to consumers, but also to the gig economy workers themselves, knowing that there are companies out there that will hire them on, I guess, fairer, more equitable terms?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely going to change. I think it's hard to predict what exactly is going to change. I think there'll definitely be, like you said, and, you know, there clearly is, I hadn't actually seen that example you mentioned, but, you know, there's clearly already opening up some other alternatives. And I think there will, you know.
Okay. Yeah, the name of the company is Zap, yeah.
And I think a lot of consumers, especially younger consumers, I think they want to, you know, they want to have an ethical, quote unquote, ethical option there. And I think there will be a market for that. If one comes out, like, you know, this will have some kind of audience just from the fact that, you know, people don't have to feel guilty about using it. Because that's the other thing. If you have an alternative, people probably would use it. You know, I think a lot of people still turn to companies like Amazon and Uber, which have horrific track records just because of the convenience. And it's like, well, if you're not going to order from Amazon, where else
you're
going to order from, kind of thing. So if you have that alternative, I think people will go to it. How many people, I don't know. But I mean, I think what would be to see, you know, if this data trust thing takes off, if you can find a way to just kind of have a driver-controlled version of Uber. Because what's Uber really own? It owns the platform. It doesn't own the cars. It doesn't own, you know, all these costs and overheads have gone the drivers themselves. So why not just let them run it and book it all themselves? That would be pretty interesting. I'd be pretty, I'd love to see something like that come out as an alternative.
Disrupting the disruptors. Caroline, you maybe have a clearer memory of this as I do with conferences 2 or 3 years ago. It was just a matter of time before some keynote would mention Uber, Airbnb, etc. The app economy, how it was so cool that they didn't own the cars.
Yeah, they didn't own the hotels.
This is supposed to be kind of some radical, you know, revolutionary transformation of the economy that, and all companies should aim to be more like Travis Kalanick's Uber, etc. I wonder if when we get back to proper conferences, we'll still hear that kind of thing. Probably not. What has been Uber's side of this, though, Seb? I mean, Their CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, it's an Iranian name. He came in, didn't he, after Travis, to try and kind of change the company in some ways. I mean, how you referred to kind of an op-ed you did. What's been Uber's side of the story?
Well, in terms of
presentation, so they're saying this is something that's a choice that you know.
Yeah, no, I think that's just So obviously, in his op-ed, this is a direct quote from him, so I'll just say this, I guess. Our thinking on this issue has evolved over time, and I'll be the first to admit we've struggled to identify solutions that work for Uber and those who earn on our platform. And then he said, instead, we've decided to turn the page. So, I mean, yeah, I think it's just a bit from their side. I mean, from the outside looking in, that just seems like pretty standard PR spin, to be honest. Like I said earlier, you know, they fought it every step of the way, right up to the UK Supreme Court, you know. Yeah. But in terms of, you know, in that same article, he was kind of calling for, and I think this comes back to that idea of multi-apping, and that riders or drivers are multi-apping, that he wants other companies in this space to now also take the steps that Uber has been forced to. I think that the thinking there is that if Uber, like we said earlier, that the this could all come at quite a big financial cost to Uber if it has to take on all these overhead, paying drivers more, getting more involved with the upkeep of their cars and things like that. That's, and even going back to the compensation again, I think that from Uber's perspective, it's other companies to change their behavior now, so that in its mind, I think that's the way it's going to remain competitive. So I think we're going to see more in the coming months of kind of Uber in a weird way actually pushing other companies to adopt better positions, but I think that will purely come out of its self-interest to remain competitive. That's what I think.
And Seb's written a lot about worker resistance in the gig economy for Computer Weekly, not just the stuff that we've discussed today. Now, as usual, I mean, we'll provide links to the stories that we've discussed today in the article that goes with the podcast, and you can read that summary on computerweekly.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast too on Apple, Google, and on Amazon Music. And you can also ask Alexa, who is H? Go on, I dare you. As I said, we're recording on the 23rd of April, so 2 days ahead of episode 6 of season 6 of Line of Duty. I'm not sure if Seb's a big fan of LOD, but we are.
I've never watched an episode, I've got to say.
No, you're missing it.
Oh, dear.
it is about combating corruption in the police, Seb, if that helps to swing you over to watching it. But sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this week. So, Seb, thanks very much indeed for joining us today and talking us through all of that. Put you through the ringer there.
thank you very much for having me.
And as ever and always, thank you so much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening to us and getting all the way to the end. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah.